Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing the creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
I think it's about resources. It's about control of the U.S. empire and ensuring U.S. unilateral power around the world. The U.S. is losing that grasp of power. And so a lot of countries are being targeted with economic sanctions and economic warfare. It's a shame that banks are being used as a weapon of war, but that's what is happening in Venezuela, Nicaragua, Hong Kong, China, Russia, Syria. These are economic weapons that the United States uses, and it's going to really cost the United States because you can already see how countries are working around U.S. sanctions, cutting the United States out of trade deals, not using the dollar in making these deals. So dollar domination is going to come to an end, and that's going to have a big impact on the U.S. economy, and will be one more step toward the end of U.S. empire and the end of U.S. unilateralism around the world.
That's the voice of Kevin Zeese, a dearly departed colleague who passed away last weekend quite suddenly. Kevin has been a guiding light for all democratic activists in recent decades, as he and his wife, Dr. Margaret Flowers, tended to many issues on the national and international stage, driving the discussion and action that attended such issues as international trade, health system issues, American imperialism, corporate power and abuse, and so many other frontline issues of American life. Kevin and Margaret have maintained an active website called popularresistance.org, a radio program, public events and presentations, and done groundbreaking work on the underlying issues that confront many aspects of the status quo of living, which beset the vitality and promise of American life. They were even arrested earlier this year for occupying the Washington, D.C. Embassy for Venezuela with that country's permission. An exciting life has just ended, and today we will pay homage to it. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. Today's program will spend a bit more time with Kevin and Margaret to revisit the gifts of their work and their insights into how we can all move on from here. An homage to a great American soul and spirit that has inspired so many. Kevin and Margaret have been on this program several times, and we'll listen to some excerpts of their contributions in previous programs. Also, we'll talk with Ellen in a moment about the momentous upheavals in international economies as an outcome of what some consider to be draconian demands of central governments that their citizens shut down daily business and affairs to take action against further spread of the coronavirus pandemic. It's become quite a hot topic for those who question whether the current approach is appropriate or whether it's undermining the civil rights of citizens, a question that is likely to be unresolved by the trading of opinions and variations of scientific facts being brought out from all corners of the globe. It seems to be the case that there is no way for us to escape the uncertainties of collective living with so many different sources responsible for securing the well-being of so many. We live together, but too often we don't trust each other, and perhaps with good reason. Whatever, here we are faced with new economic demands and situations that may be bringing about a permanent change in our systems and capacities. Ellen refers to it as the Great Reset, which we'll talk about in a moment. Kevin Zeese's life was certainly about resetting the human condition onto a new road of health, democracy, and renewed priorities of people over planet. Let's talk with Ellen now.
Well, Ellen, we've lost a dear friend and an important, powerful colleague this week. What do you remember about Kevin Zeis?
Oh, he was a wonderful guy, but a great worker. He worked on so many important projects and just had a lot of energy. He started out working for Ralph Nader. He was his lawyer, and you know, and then got into the Central America and like Nicaragua and Venezuela. You know, the Venezuelan issues. Spent some time in the Venezuelan embassy, basically locked in there, along with Margaret, and died of a heart attack, apparently, at the age of 65, which seems quite young to me.
Well, Kevin's stand for justice and fairness and also against the imperialism, the imperialistic capitalism of our country has been, you know, really on the cutting edge of civic consciousness. And as you say, it was a really hard worker, just unfailingly cranking out presentations and radio shows and articles and, you know, a very active website called popularresistance.org. And he really embodied the spirit of what a democracy looks like these days, or is trying to look like these days, in the face of a tremendous amount of powerful, superimposed, oligarchic arrogance.
That's exactly what I was going to talk about for my latest article. Yeah, oligarchic arrogance. Globalist oligarchy. Yep. Actually took to the streets, you know, put his body on the line, he and Margaret.
Yeah.
They were very brave.
The thing that you mentioned a moment ago about their action at the Venezuelan embassy, which they got arrested for, but they were with several other people who moved into the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., with the permission of the Maduro government, the elected government of Venezuela, to protect it from a CIA basically backed coup to take over the Maduro government and to occupy the embassy for Juan Guaido, who was this president of, I think, the Venezuelan Assembly, positioned in power by basically our interests, the CIA once again moving in a strategy to take over the money of Venezuela, the economy, and the government. Now, that sounds maybe extreme, but when you look at what the administration has done to deprive Venezuela of their Citgo profits, which I think are $7 billion, they can't get their money back. And they've got an international cooperation. So basically what I'm describing here is a scenario in which Kevin and his wife, Dr. Margaret Flowers, and these other people took it over and took a stand to protect it, finally agreed to leave. When they were taken to court, the judge threw out the case. But they were facing long prison sentences. Now, that sort of frontline stands for a guy like Kevin Zeis, our dearly departed brother, is not far off of what I think you're kind of referring to in some of your portrayal of the COVID-19 response and what you're seeing is a great reset. Can you tell us a little bit about where you're coming from with that, and certainly in the light of Kevin's life as well?
Yeah, well, I haven't actually taken to the streets since the 1960s when we called it the Age of Aquarius, but now they're calling it the Great Reset. So my last article was called From Lockdown to Police State, The Great Reset Rolls Out. So what I was talking about was the fact that in Melbourne, Australia, the lockdown that has been imposed globally has all the features of a police state. I mean, it's quite shocking, and it looks like we all could be heading in that direction, that the police could actually enter without a warrant and make sure you're not violating the rules, which in Melbourne are that you can't congregate, you know, you can't socialize even with your neighbors, like have a neighbor over for a drink or something. You can't do that anymore. And they have a curfew and other restrictions that really don't make any sense. This was all because of apparently an increase of 11 deaths alleged to be due to the COVID-19 virus. But these were all deaths in nursing homes, so they clearly all had comorbidities, you know. So there are many strange things about this lockdown that's been imposed globally, and it is clearly destroying economies, and the question is why. So one thing I wrote about was the fact that the test that has established that we even have a pandemic or an epidemic, the PCR test, was demonstrated in, there was an article in the New York Times in 2007 where the PCR test actually created the appearance of an epidemic where there was none. This was in a hospital where they tested 1,000 workers for whooping cough, and they thought they had an epidemic, and they sent everybody home. And 8 months later, when they tested the same people against the actual whooping cough virus, there were none. They were all false positives. So the epidemic itself was created by the test. And here we're all, countries everywhere, just being told, test, test, test. Why is that? Arguably to create the appearance of an epidemic that isn't really there. So who would benefit from that? I mean, you could see where, obviously, the drug companies will benefit. Whoever wins the contracts for these vaccines, which supposedly will never get back to normal until we have a vaccine, and the vaccine makers are exempted from liability for side effects. Anyway, there's a bill in, I think, 2006 or 2007 that makes side effects from vaccines are paid by the government, not by the vaccine maker. And for drug companies, this is a great gold mine because that's their biggest cost, paying for side effects. So that's one possibility, but it's hard to envision that big pharmaceutical companies are that powerful that they could shut down the whole global economy. But there is an entity called the World Economic Forum that meets every January in Davos, Switzerland, where all the big heads of the big corporations meet, and they have set for their agenda in January the Great Reset. And their plan for the Great Reset is basically change everything, like the whole economic system. That apparently one of their big goals is to change the monetary system to a digital system where everybody will have a digital ID, and then they can track you and they can track your money, and they can arguably turn off your money, you know, if you don't go along with things. And they can also have your medical records in there, so you wouldn't be able to, for example, to get on a plane unless you had proof that you were either tested negative for this virus or that you had gotten a vaccine or something like that. Anyway, so it's all quite nefarious and scary. And we do need a reset. I mean, the word reset has been used for decades, but it's usually applied to a monetary reset of some sort or a debt jubilee. And we clearly have debts so big that there's no way they can ever be paid off. I mean, every country is heavily in debt, and then there's the derivatives, trillions of dollars in derivatives. I mean, they're just in corporate debt and individual debt are just huge. So we do need a reset of some sort. Or the problem with a debt jubilee is that today the creditors are private. And so if you acknowledge the rights of private property, you can't force the banks to write off these debts. But if they were public banks, you could. And that's what Michael Hudson has written about that happened thousands of years ago in Mesopotamia when they actually routinely did have debt jubilees. And that's where the label came from, where the king or every time you get a new king, they'd have a debt jubilee where they'd just write off all the debts and start over, because the king and the temple were the lenders, and so they could do that. They could write off the debts, or whenever they had any kind of plague or some sort of environmental crisis or whatever, they could just do a reset where they set the debts back to zero. So we do need a reset, and so I thought I'd write next about what kind of reset we need or what we could do that would actually work. We've seen in the CARES Act that once again, the big corporations got bailed out, but the ordinary workers got crushed, and they're the ones footing the bill. So the CARES Act pumped out several trillion dollars for the big corporations. And then the argument is, well, they can't pump any more money out. This is all money created by the Federal Reserve. I mean, it was, you know, a lot of it is debt of the U.S. government, but who buys that debt? The Federal Reserve bought a lot of it. So anyway, the money ultimately is coming from this deep pocket of the Federal Reserve. Well, I would argue that we need to get back to constitutional principles, one of which is Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. So it should actually be Congress should have control of the Federal Reserve, or it should be the Treasury rather than the Fed that has the power to issue money directly. The Treasury does have the power to issue coins, and it could issue some trillion-dollar coins, which I proposed in my book, Web of Debt, in 2007. One possibility is that, where the government could issue the money directly. I mean, if we've already pumped a couple $1 trillion out to save the stock market and the big corporations, we could pump out a couple more trillion of new money, money created out of nothing, and it would not be inflationary. I mean, I've written about that before, but you could call it a universal basic income. But anyway, if it went directly into people's pockets, it's necessary to fill the gap between debt and the money available to repay it at the moment. I mean, you have to, in order to have a balanced system, all of our money is created by banks as debt, you know, as we know.
Yeah.
And so you've got to have enough money out there. You've got to have enough demand or money in people's pockets to buy the products that they create in order to have a balanced system. I mean, the argument is we've got too much money out there now because of these trillions that have been added from the CARES Act, but that money has not gone into the pockets of the consumers, and it's the consumer market that needs it. So we need to add some more. It's gone into the stock market and asset prices and all those big things, but it hasn't gone into the pockets of the people. So that's one possibility. It also hasn't gone to the state and local governments, as we've discussed before. They got the short end of the stick with the CARES Act, where they got only $150 billion divided by 50 states. So that's an average of $3 billion each. And what would we do about that? If we go back to basic principles, I mean, I would say our basic constitutional principles are the right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence, which people have been deprived of, and it's the government's responsibility to repay that. Just like with eminent domain, if the government takes your property, they need to compensate you for it, and it's the government that has ordered these lockdowns or shutdowns of businesses and taken away people's incomes.
Yeah.
So that's one basic principle. And another, if you want to go back to the founding of the country, would be Hamilton's bank, which Hamilton bought the state's debts, and that's how he used the debt as a currency, basically. And it is a form of currency. You know, if you have federal debt, you can actually go to the bank with your federal debt. I mean, it's a bond. It looks kind of like money. You can go to the bank with your bond and deposit it, and the bank will actually call it money. So that's what Hamilton did, and we could do that with the state's debts as well. Or the central bank could do it, buy up the state's debt and give the states credit for it.
So that would be a huge reset in just in that example, a reset of how we're organized. Well, you know, I know that it's a difficult thing to run a world, and there are a lot of people who are in positions of responsibility to make judgment calls. Obviously, there's a very strong contention about who's making the calls on the COVID issue. Maybe a moment of reset without a guiding light about what we want to reset to, except for what we kind of referred to in the past as a possible age of Aquarius, you know, where there can be sufficiency and people can be cared for and the planet won't be wrecked and et cetera, et cetera. But that's not going to stop the contention between people and parties over what they believe to be true or not. Maybe we can reset some of our circumstances, but we probably can't reset too much of humanity. Whether it's a pandemic phenomenon, or whether it's an unlivable wage.
Or
the
a
balances,
coup.
Yes, or possibly a coup. The world is moving into hopefully into a new age in which life and the planet will take priority over profits and greed and domination and control. But I'm not going to hold my breath, but let's just keep working on it like our brother Kevin did. You know, Kevin Zeese has left us at a time of great excitement, and we're really on a precipice to see what happens with humanity and our economy and the well-being of the planet.
At a turning point. Yeah. My mother lived to be 97, and she said she just wanted to see how it turned out. That's the reason for hanging around.
Well, Mom, this is it. Today is how it's turning out. So.
Yeah, we're still waiting. But it does seem to me that we have an obligation, you know, to do what we can to make
Absolutely.
It turn the right way.
Absolutely.
We can't just watch. Well, in other words, it's a critical time.
Yeah. Well, thanks for all the work that you do for us to look into it and to make some sense of it. And we'll see what happens next.
And thanks for your work, too. Thanks, Kevin, and may he rest in peace.
May he rest in power, as they're saying.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, rest in power.
Kevin Zeese was a guiding light of our age of revolution and transformation. Revolution is a big, powerful word that connotes many troublesome images. But in the context of Kevin's life as an activist leader, attorney, and expert on national and international concerns, it was due process for democracy that the citizens stay alert and abreast of what's going on around them and who's doing what to whom, and how the activities of the powerful ultimately come to rest on the shoulders of those less powerful. Kevin's life was on duty, on an endless assignment of resting, reclaiming, and retaining power for the people. His understanding of people was everyone, all of us, no matter where we live. It was in that sense of duty that Kevin and his wife, Dr. Margaret Flowers, took a bold, courageous stand to defend a foreign embassy from a covert action by our own government to take it over for a strategic advantage and to prop up an American narrative in the interest of serving private profit. We're going to listen now to an excerpt of Ellen's discussion with Kevin and Margaret from earlier this year on this program, after they had been arrested for moving into the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., with the permission of the duly elected Venezuelan government that the U.S. was, and still is, trying to overthrow. Listening to this discussion, you'll hear clear echoes of Michael Hudson's description of how private capital interests are now waging a new type of war, an economic one that disables and then takes over a nation, generally without firing a single shot.
There are other connections to money. I mean, one of the major things going on in Venezuela is a U.S. economic war where they have even stopped the U.K. bank from returning gold that Venezuela has deposited in the bank. And so they've been turning the Western financial system against Venezuela to stop it from having access to financial markets and to resulting in shrinking its economy and causing incredible economic challenges for the people of Venezuela. We're being prosecuted in federal court because we were the final four, Margaret Flowers and I were two of the final four people who were in the Venezuelan embassy last spring, last April and May, when the U.S. government sought to allow it to be taken over as part of their right-wing regime change, you know, coup effort in Venezuela. So we are facing federal charges in the U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. People can read about it on defendembassyprotectors.org. That's the site of the committee that formed to support our case, defendembassyprotectors.org. And we're being prosecuted for interfering with protective function of the State Department. We're not being prosecuted for trespass or unlawful entry because we were in the embassy with the permission of the elected government of Venezuela. They gave us a key. We could go in and out. And for the first half of the 37 days we were in the embassy, we could go in and out with no problem. But then on April 30th, there was another coup attempt by the U.S. puppet Juan Guaido and in Caracas, and that failed immediately. But at the same time that happened, there was a whole group of pro-coup supporters, a pro-coup mob made up of various people from Latin American countries who had fled their countries, Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, who left their countries when left-wing governments were put in power, and they were out there terrorizing us. We were under siege at the Venezuelan embassy. There were about 70 people staying in the embassy at night. In the first part, before the siege began, we had events every night, forums on AFRICOM, on Honduras. We had John Kiriakou, a former CIA agent, who talked about what it's like to regime change, what it's like from inside the CIA, which is a really interesting talk that should have gotten national attention because it had some really great information in it. And we had concerts and cultural events, and so we had 100 people coming in and out of the embassy at night, 70 people staying there overnight, and then when the siege began, they were trying to terrorize us. And by that point, some people had already left because they had to go back to work or school or take care of kids or go back to their job and couldn't spend the night in the embassy any longer, or for health reasons they left. But as the coup mob outside began to block food coming in the embassy, assault people who were our supporters outside the embassy, and when people were assaulted who were supporting us, they were the ones arrested, not the person committing the assault. And the police didn't do anything to stop the mob from blocking food from getting in. It seemed pretty obvious that the police and the mob were working hand in hand. We even overheard police talking to each other outside. We could hear from the garage, in the driveway in the garage, there was a shift change, and the police were describing the situation to the new shift, and they said that the people who were outside the embassy, right by the embassy, the police had allowed them to put up tents and equipment and just surround the embassy. The people outside the embassy were essentially the government, the police said. And then they said the people outside of that, we had a whole group of people beyond that who are our supporters. They're peace activists who are paid by Russia or something. So that was the police perspective. And then we also overheard some of the coup mob talking on the phone to people, and they said that they were essentially trying to terrorize us to get us to leave the embassy. And they were doing that because under international law, the Vienna Convention does not allow the host government, in this case the United States, to go into the embassy of a government that has an embassy in the U.S. And so they needed the permission of the elected government of Venezuela to enter the embassy. And so they were trying to frighten us with all sorts of noise and these strobe lights that were blinding us, and just constant verbal attacks and physical assaults on our allies. It was just amazing conflict that should have been covered by the corporate media, because it was really in the heart of Washington, D.C., in the very expensive neighborhood of Georgetown, this big embassy, 5 floors with a basement and 2 floors of garage below it. Big embassy that housed 80 people was surrounded and under siege and in constant conflict. It would have been great TV, but it really showed how well the government controls the corporate media that this was not covered, because it would have raised questions about the U.S. coup attempt in Venezuela, and people would have to start to ask questions about who's president, what happened with this Guaido, what's this going on. It would have started to explain things and pierce the false narrative that is just getting worse and worse, by the way. And so we're facing, with these federal charges, up to a year in jail and up to a $100,000 fine each. So that's pretty serious,
wow.
a big, big fine. And the most recent developments are that the Trump prosecutors filed a motion to limit what the jury is allowed to hear. That's called a motion in limine. This is very common with jury trials. It's basically the rules of the trial. And in this motion in limine, the government is asking that we not mention that Maduro is the president, that we not question the legitimacy of Guaido, that we do not tell the jury that we were in the embassy with the permission of the elected government, and that food was being blocked, that there was a mob outside, that we cooperated with the police to help protect the embassy. All the amazing. If the judge approves this motion, it'll be very hard for us to tell the truth to the jury, especially to tell the whole truth, because if we can't say we were in the embassy with the permission of the elected government, who is the elected government? Maduro's administration is the elected government. The jury will be totally confused, and we won't have much of a defense if we can't tell the truth. So the judge will decide that on January 29th. And then if things go according to plan, February 11th is the current date for the trial to begin. So people are organizing. The defense committee is getting people aware and up to date on what's going on. There's a frequently asked questions page on the defendembassyprotectors.org website, so we can get more information. And people then can also come to Washington, D.C., or if they're in Washington, D.C., come to the trial and participate in being in the audience and really showing the judge that we do have some political support.
Wow, that's amazing. You're heroes in my book for going through all that.
That's the bizarre thing about it. You know, when we were in the embassy, we didn't realize how many people were watching the live stream. We had embedded journalists who were in the embassy and people outside. Telesur was covering it regularly. People in Latin America knew about it, and people watching the live streams knew about it. And we've been doing a tour. We just got back from Florida. We already had gone to California and Illinois. We're about to do a tour in New Jersey, Philadelphia, New York City, New Haven, and Massachusetts. And so people can come out and hear more about it at the during the tour, or they can donate to our legal defense fund as well on the defendembassyprotectors.org website. And when we go on tour, it's amazing how people were watching this on almost an hourly basis. For many people, this was a gripping conflict. And we were told that from people in Venezuela that our action totally changed the conversation about Americans in Venezuela. People were amazed that U.S. citizens would put themselves at risk for the Venezuelan government and for the independence of Venezuela. You know, this was not a pro-Maduro event or anything. It was a pro-sovereignty, pro-independence event, and an opposition to U.S. imperialism. They actually had solidarity marches in Venezuela while we were in the embassy, which, you know, had signs, Margaret, you're a hero, Kevin, you're a hero, and our other, and it was like, and people were sending us through Twitter and social media songs they had written about us and performing songs about us that they had written. It was just, and sending us positive tweets. It was just really incredible, the response. And so Latin America is very aware of this. Most people in the United States are not aware of it. The only corporate media, I should say, that covered this was when we were arrested. And so the story was four arrested at Venezuelan embassy. None of the context of what was really going on. People had no idea it was a 37-day project with 70 people sleeping in the embassy and hundreds of people going in and out of the embassy to show support for international law and to prevent a takeover of the embassy by a failed coup. It was an incredible experience, and we hope that we get a fair trial. If we get a fair trial, I think we'll be acquitted. If not, we'll just do our best to build the movement based on the unjust trial. So either way, we're going to try to keep building the movement to end the U.S. Intervention and regime change efforts in Venezuela.
Wow. And people, Americans, we think that we have a free press, and we think that we are better than the rest of the world because, you know, better than China, let's say, because we really know what's going on. We have access to that information, but we really don't. People don't realize what they don't know. They don't know what they don't know.
That's the thing that we have seen when we have traveled. I've been to Venezuela twice in the last year. I was there earlier about this time a year ago, and I was in Venezuela for the election in May of 2018 when President Maduro was reelected. Yes, there was an election. He is not a dictator. I saw the election. There were five candidates running. He won 67% of the vote. There was a very strong opposition candidate who was a former governor in one of the states, and so it was a real election. The U.S. Tried very hard to get people in Venezuela to boycott the election. They even threatened Henry Falcon, the leading candidate against Maduro, threatened him with sanctions if he ran against Maduro, because they knew they couldn't beat Maduro, the United States, so they wanted to undermine the legitimacy of the election by boycotting it. That's often what U.S. coups do when they can't win democratically. They try to claim it's not a democracy and boycott the election and try to falsify that it was not really an election. But in fact, there were more than 300 international election observers monitoring that election from Venezuela. And I was there invited by Intrepid News Service to go down there and report on it. I've been an election integrity activist in the United States. Among some of the issues I've worked on has been improving our electoral system. And the fact is that Venezuela runs elections better than many U.S. states do. And they do that with great intention. Under the Venezuelan Constitution, unlike the U.S. Constitution, there is a right to vote. As a result, they have 96% of people in Venezuela registered to vote. They actually take it upon themselves, the government does, to register people. They want to get to 100%. That's far superior than U.S. registration. Of course, in the U.S., we are deleting people from registration rolls rather than adding people to them. And they do a number of unusual things. I'll just mention one. On election day, before they announce a vote result, every precinct is required to do a random audit of 54% of the machines on election day. And they can do this because, unlike the U.S. and many parts of the United States, they have both an electronic vote and a paper ballot. So the paper ballot is reviewed by the voter and put into a ballot box. At the end of the day, the randomly selected machines, the 54% of the machines that are in, they take the paper ballot, they count each ballot with the media, the public, all parties, opposition candidates, all candidates are allowed to see this vote count. They show every ballot to everybody, and they count it. And they compare that to the electronic vote. If it's consistent, then they count the votes from that precinct. If not, they count all the votes by hand from that precinct. And so that they call that a people's audit. In the U.S., of course, some places cannot do an audit because there is only an electronic ballot, and a recount is just pressing the machine again, and the same machine recounts it. If there's a software error, you get the same software error result. And in places that do have a paper ballot, a recount, there's lots of rules about recounts and audits that make it very hard to have a recount or an audit. And so the Venezuelan takes the opposite approach. They make the audit a routine part and make it a public part of the process. That's just one example, along with registration. Those are just two examples of how the democracy in Venezuela is actually superior to the U.S. in many ways. And if we would stop calling Venezuela a dictatorship, we could actually learn a lot about democracy in Venezuela. They're moving toward direct democracy, where the people participate in decision making, and want to see that as the method of democracy for the future. Right now, it's a representative democracy, but they do have participatory direct democracy at the local level. It's a really interesting process, and we could learn so much from Venezuela about what deep democracy really looks like.
Wow, that's great. So what's your sense of why are we blockading Venezuela economically, and just like we're blockading Iran economically, and which is technically an act of war, I think.
That's a great question. I think the U.S. economic wars around the world are first off illegal. We call them sanctions in the United States. What they really are is unilateral coercive measures. Under the UN Charter, you cannot coerce governments to change their representation. And unilateral coercive measures, these sanctions are designed to force countries to change and bend to the U.S. will. That's a very serious abuse of economic power, a serious abuse of the Western banking power, because all of these sanctions involve blocking Western banks from financing projects in those countries. I think the reasons why Venezuela is targeted are two reasons. One, it's a bad example. It's an example of a country that declared its independence, is no longer controlled by the United States, is no longer part of U.S. empire as it was prior to 1999 when Hugo Chavez was elected. I think the same is true for Iran. When they had their revolution in 1979, they broke from U.S. domination, ending the rule of the Shah, who was put in place by the United States and controlled by the United States. They are being punished for their independence. I think that's true of Venezuela, too. The U.S. does not want to see an example of a country that can leave the U.S. empire and succeed. So they do their best to destroy those economies. And if that doesn't work, then it goes into regime change, cyber attacks, which we've seen in Venezuela, goes into military threats, military wars. It gets, you know, escalates from there. The second reason I think that Venezuela is under attack is because it has tremendous resources. People already know, I think most people know, Venezuela has the most oil reserves of any country in the world. They have the highest reserves of diamonds and of gold of any country in the world. They're number one in all three of those, number five in gases. But I think the most important thing the U.S. wants is their minerals. They have minerals that are essential for electronics and for weapons. The U.S. has a real problem with that. The U.S. has to even rely on China for some of those minerals. And China is our number one target in this era of great power conflict, which is the new national security doctrine. The war on terror is over. Now we're in a phase of great power conflict with Russia and China at the top of the list. Iran is on the list as well. But the U.S. cannot be dependent on China for precious metals. And so they need to find another source. And Venezuela is one of those sources, just as Bolivia is a major source for lithium, which is critical to electric batteries, you know, for batteries for cars and the future of electronics. Bolivia had made an agreement with China to mine lithium, and Bolivia was going to produce products from that lithium. And that shortly after that deal was made was when the coup that's currently ongoing in Bolivia began against Evo Morales. So although they had tried various coups before against Morales, they escalated once this lithium deal was made. So I think it's about resources. It's about control of the U.S. empire and ensuring U.S. Unilateral power around the world. I think that's the U.S. is losing that grasp of power. And so a lot of countries are being targeted with economic sanctions and economic warfare. It's a shame that banks are being used as a weapon of war. But that's what is happening in Venezuela, Nicaragua, Hong Kong, China, Russia, I mean, Syria. These are economic weapons that the United States uses. And it's going to really cost the United States because you can already see how countries are working around U.S. sanctions, cutting the United States out of trade deals, not using the dollar in making these deals. So dollar domination is going to come to an end, and that's going to have a big impact on the U.S. economy, and will be one more step toward the end of U.S. empire and the end of U.S. unilateralism around the world.
Wow, you said that so well. Thanks, Kevin. You have some great insights on all that, and you've really done great work.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. We expect to see a boomerang to these years. And our position now on all these issues we've talked about is to define what we want. What do we want from healthcare? What do we want from trade? What do we want from the Internet? How do we serve ourselves and the future generations? And I think that all comes down to that fight about public versus corporate, and that's the fight.
That's Kevin Zeese, wrapping up our retrospective of his life, work, and message. Kevin left this stage suddenly last weekend. His life and work had significant impact for everyone actively engaged in confronting injustice and unfairness in our public affairs, systems, and institutions. At the outset of his career, he worked with Ralph Nader in challenging the under-challenged power of corporate profiteering, which left consumers to fend for themselves as users of products. He's been on the literal and figurative front lines of change and transformation, opening thinking about core public interest issues such as hemispherical trade deals that overlooked labor and environmental concerns, the failed U.S. medical insurance and health frontier, abusive corporate practices and laws, and of course, public banking, which he and wife Dr. Margaret Flowers have strongly defended and supported with PBI for years. So let us take a few more moments to hear from Kevin about his work with Margaret in a conversation that Ellen and I had with them on this program not so long ago, in which they address the underlying opportunities and strategies to bring our world into a transformative age of new priorities and a stronger democracy.
Thinking about all three of the issues we talked about, the trade issue, the net neutrality issue, and the health issue, these are all areas we have campaigns which people can get involved with on our main website, which is popularresistance.org. We just redid that website, by the way. All the campaigns are there, and you can sign up for each campaign to get mailings on each. The thing that's common about all three is it's the classic overall fight of our times. It's people and people organizing power to challenge corporate power and challenge the power of the wealthy. It's people versus corporations, each one of these conflicts. If we solve the healthcare crisis, Ellen, you mentioned China, state-owned enterprises, because we put in place Medicare for everybody. Medicare is a government program. One of the arguments for net neutrality is this is maybe is now we should look at internet access as a human right. It's essential for functioning. And that means that this should be under democratic control. It shouldn't be something that a handful of corporations control. When we talk about trade for people and planet. It's people and environment-based trade versus corporate-dominated trade. So it's all these issues. And it's the same with the issue of public banking that you all work for, Ellen. Again, who controls finance? Is it going to be a handful of big banks on Wall Street, or is it going to be democratically controlled banks like public banks? And beyond that could be credit unions, which are worker-owned banking systems. And so this is the overall challenge that we're facing, and the issues we're talking about today really show this is the issue that unites the movement into a movement of movements on a whole number of fronts.
So I want to remind the listeners that the Internet was actually created through our taxpayer dollars through the Department of Defense, and then that got turned over to those telecom communications who are not only controlling our access to it in terms of speed and things, but they also are buying up content. And so they can start prioritizing their content over other content because they want to make more money off of their content. And so an exciting movement in this realm is cities creating their own municipally owned internet, and they are able to provide higher quality, faster speed, and universal access to the internet. Because, these telecoms come into cities and they don't provide access to the entire city. They don't go into the neighborhoods where they don't think they're going to make a profit. And so we actually can serve people better if we bring the internet back in under public control, just like water or a public utility.
I totally agree.
Or
it's
banks.
One of those things that flows between people, like money. I mean, it's one of those things
right.
that should be in the public sector. I read somewhere, James Galbraith said that half of every economy is public and half is private. Roughly. But in our case, the half that's public is the military. Now, if we could, put some of those enlisted men on local projects or, rebuild like infrastructure or something, local infrastructure, instead of sending them off abroad, that would be much more.
Well, if you look at foreign policy, then you get to really interesting issues about our economy, because we really have what I would call an empire economy. And while that served people in the United States for a while with less expensive goods and didn't undermine our job situation, now it's no longer serving people in the United States. And the U.S. empire is under great stress. The U.S. hasn't won a war really since World War II, at least not any significant war. The expense is massive as far as the expense to our discretionary federal spending goes. We have bases from all over the world. Trump just broke the record for a number of countries where we have special operations, 149 countries now. The United States has military special ops working. And so the question is, how do you end empire? Because empire is no longer serving us and is fading.
and it's not producing the kind of economic benefits. It's an economic drain. And so how do we end empire? And I think your comment about those people who are enlisted now or in the military leaving the military, becoming civilians, and beginning to work on the needs at home. You know, when Trump ran on America First, traditionally America First was an anti-war group, you know, back in the pre-World War II era. But when he runs, now he has generals put in even his chief of staff is a former general. So he's put generals in lots of different parts of the government. He's increased the military spending. He's increased spending on improving nuclear weapons. And he's now put us in more countries than any president before him. So he's been the opposite of America First. He's been America abroad first. And domestically, all he's doing is helping the wealthy. You can see in the current tax bill. It's not a bill for the people. It's a bill for the ultra-rich. And so this is a real scam that needs to be exposed, and because we expect to see a boomerang to these years. And our position now on all these issues we've talked about is to define what we want. What do we want from healthcare? What do we want from trade? What do we want from the Internet? How do we serve ourselves and the future generations? And I think that all comes down to that fight about public versus corporate, and that's the fight.
I had one more comment about the Internet. I heard Catherine Austin Fitz interviewed someone in Australia who was an expert on it was an interview on 5G and how horribly toxic mm-hmm. this is going to be. Mm-hmm. And yet 5G is necessary for all the expansion of all these things that we actually like. You know, it's very handy to have your cell phone, et cetera. And so this man said that it actually could be fixed. The toxicity part could be fixed. You just have to overlay it with the resonance of the Earth, which is 7.83 hertz, I guess. So I just thought that was, you know, while you're out there campaigning, if that issue ever comes up, just point out there is a fix. It just will cost a little money, and of course they're going to be opposed to it. But if it's the people worried about their own health, they would incorporate that in there.
It's a very interesting point, because when countries have health systems where the bottom line is health, they're universal
right.
systems, publicly financed, it actually has a wider impact on public policy, because now these countries are responsible for paying for the, you know, health care for everyone. So they don't want to actually create increased costs for themselves, healthcare costs. So things, it impacts public policy, things like public transportation, having clean, you know, reliable public transportation so fewer people drive, or making sure that the foods that people eat are, you know, are safe, they don't contain pesticides, making sure that the products that people buy don't contain hazardous chemicals. It really has this broader health impact.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
You know, we keep seeing this contrast between what is in the interest of the public and logical, commonsensical sort of steps and policies that are in the public, and how they are always confronted with the corporate interests, which are perpetuating programs and technologies that you know, that we don't necessarily need, but that are frequently harmful to us. How are we going to get past that? How do you guys see the phasing into some different world? Where we're not all the serfs and the renters in a society that's owned by others and run by corporate interests?
That's a great question. And that's why the issues we're talking about today are also important, because they all crystallize that conflict. You know, the position Ellen talked about with the 5Gs and the health risks, that's another example of profit coming before people, profit coming for health. And all these issues have that same nut that really surrounds it. Which is coming first, the corporate interest or the interest of the people and the planet? And that is the fight. And so when we win any one of these issues, you know, let me just take a little different attack at it. I'm really seeing in the future, with the extremism of Trump and the long-term corporate reality of the Democratic and Republican parties, the duopoly, you know, we have been fed in the United States this dangerous corporate food, this corporate ideology that profits of corporations come before people and planet. And there's going to be Trump is so extreme on this that there's going to be a boomerang in the future, and not too distant future. And the reaction to that, Trumpism and corporatism of the duopoly, is ours to manage, push, and dominate. This is the chance coming up for people power to really push for the world we want to see, which is a world in which people and people's necessities, where the planet and protecting the planet, dealing with climate change, all these issues will come to the front if we are smart now and define what we want on all these health issues we're talking about, from healthcare to trade to militarism to internet. We need to define what we want. And when we really get serious about defining that, it does come down to what do human beings need? What is the necessity of the people? And that comes down to the fight between corporate power and people power. And I think that's going to be resolved in the 2020s. I think we're going to see an amazing, just like during Obama, we saw a reaction with the Occupy movement calling on the wealth divide, the Black Lives Matter, on black violence and racism against African-American communities, on immigration movements, on Fight for 15. These all happened during the Obama years, the Democrat years. They were a reaction, though, to Bush. Bush's right-wing extremism pushed in Obama. Obama raised the rhetoric up of hope and change. It didn't happen, so people formed movements to try to force it to happen. This is not going to be an unusual reality. This is going to happen in the future, too. The Democratic Party will still nominate a corporate Democrat. The progressives in the Democratic world try to push it toward more of a progressive corporate Democrat. It will still be a corporate Democrat. It's up to the movements, for the people, to define what we want on all these issues that are necessities, and force that through and push this boomerang further than either duopoly party wants it to go. That's how I see it happening. But we have to do our job now of setting the framework, laying the groundwork, and organizing the people.
That's Kevin Zeis with his wife, Dr. Margaret Flowers. Forces for Change, Democracy, and Life. With lasting thanks for Kevin Zeis, may he rest in peace and in power. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.